At this point, I want to invite our other two presenters up and also give them a big hand and also open it up to the audience for questions. We've got a little bit of time for questions before the buses come. So, anyone? Yes.
Mike, for you about Facet, is it possible to network it? Can you put the software on a server that several people could access so that, say you had a curator that was determining part of your solution and you had an engineer that was doing, you know, several people working on the same piece?
Yes, you can put it on a shared drive and multiple people can access it. However, multiple people cannot enter data at the same time.
Not at the same time, but they could.
Yeah, not yet. That was too big of a piece for us to bite off in this round of development.
Okay.
But yes, we do that at the ATM.
Great.
Same time on the same record? Or?
I haven't explored the intricacies of data entry at the same time. I'm simply told by my programmer, we've not built this functionality into the tool yet. So I don't know.
I'm sorry, the gentleman on the end?
Yeah, I was interested in the source list for all of the tape brands and stock numbers. So obviously there's history behind each one of them, whether it's Scotch 111 or Soundcraft or et cetera. And I'm wondering for each of the different presentations, how big are those lists and where did the information come to back it up?
Well, I'll speak for myself. We, for example, assessing sticky shed syndrome, we assess by tape brand because we don't want to play back something that may have sticky shed because you will lose content if you do that. That list and the other tape brand lists have come from consulting with a number of audio engineers doing preservation work, audio archivists as well. Facet is based on what research is available. It's also based on the experience of engineers and archivists in doing this work for a long time. And my aim is to really take practical knowledge that exists and that many of us use every day and build that into the tool to help us make good and structured decisions.
Yeah. Anyone else?
The three of you talk about your individual decisions to go with freeform text fields for a great deal of the information as opposed to pop-up menus. Is there any particular advantage or disadvantage to either of those in an Access database? The searchability or ease of entering freeform?
In our case, what we did was many of the fields have drop-down menus and you can enter free text. So obviously, if you're searching for something and you don't have a dictionary, so if I enter acetate and someone enters cellulose acetate and you start searching for the first few letters, then you're going to get different results. But acetate, in any case, it's part of the dropdown. So that's how we did it.
We've controlled for certain things where we think it doesn't matter, acetate or cellulose acetate. We've just simply controlled for those terms. And I mean, the range of choices is limited in that situation. But we also have free text fields in certain areas as well.
Yeah, I think we have very few free text fields and actually told our surveyors not to use them very much. They were just for a couple of like other problems to describe it or just a note field at the end. But that we only told them to use for whether the record tabs had been removed or not, to make a note of that. Our archives asked us to make a note of that, but we wanted to keep it just with drop-down menus or radio buttons, just so that it was simple and there were no problems. So we do need to add, we don't have this yet, that we're going to add more advanced drop-down menus of the listing of like the manufacturer brands. We didn't do that yet, but just so there isn't the confusion.
So Hannah, did you have a question?
Yeah, I'm interested in with the NYU database, how when you just did visual inspections, you know, you got some scary numbers. But then if you went ahead and did go do some playback, it changed those numbers considerably. And I'm just wondering if you all could speak to the advantages and disadvantages of doing assessments without any playback involved. And where that really, you know, what does that mean when your results are kind of so skewed without having the opportunity to play that?
I guess I don't. I mean, the it's the numbers there, the ones, and that was the ones that had passed. It was just the ones that had gone to playback. Mm-hmm. So ideally, those should have been much higher than the ones from just the playback, because the idea was, from just the visual inspection, because the idea was, if it passed visual inspection, then it should pass playback, or that was our hope, that it would, we would be able to do something where we could inspect it physically, and then that would tell us, okay, this will play back fine, we don't need to worry about it. So that was how we tried to set that, and that's something that that's part of the research that we're doing, is to see, you know, are we able to do this? Can you look at it, smell it, you know, mark these things, and that will tell you, yes, it's fine for playback, you won't damage it, it's going to be okay. And so that was, I guess that's part of now what we're trying to figure out is, did that work?
My thinking is that for many archives, playback is not really an option, because of lack of expertise or time. It takes a lot of time to safely play back an item. And if you don't know how to identify if it's deteriorating on a machine, then you can get yourself into trouble. I also have to say that our experience with open reel tape is a little different than Josh's, in that I think a much higher percentage of tape is playable, and we can, and even the stuff that looks bad, we can make work. And that kind of experience is factored into the tool as well.
Well, I think I'm sure many of those things would have worked if we had had the expertise in mm-hmm. in our surveyors, but that was a problem that, you know, and people who would come in and say, yes, that could play back, but our surveyors would not want to play it back because they would be worried, especially if the content was something special, or they just didn't know how to deal, especially with open reel tape. So that was a factor, I think, in that.
And that's something I think hasn't been addressed, but surveyor bias can be huge. Mm-hmm. So I think one thing that we'd like to test, I don't know if we're gonna have time, is I give you this tape and I give you this tool. I give you this tape and I give you this tool. Do you come up with the same results?
Yeah.
And that's something that needs to be tested, I think.
And that's one of the reasons that we developed the formats document, is to give some guidelines and some help in doing the assessment so that we can hopefully achieve greater consistency. But there's things that probably you need to do within any given institution for consistency, like having limited number of people doing the rankings. And the process that we've used, at the ATM, we've had two people ranking collections, myself and then another person, and we've started sitting down and comparing notes. In effect, we're justifying our rankings to each other for every collection, and that process has proved very useful.
The gentleman in the back.
This question is for Marlos. And excuse me if I'm not familiar with the academic criteria for value, but I'm curious as to how that is assessed. I'm presuming it has to be relational compared to other pieces of tape or other artifacts. And I mean, excluding the obvious of celebrities or famous personages, how do you determine actual value as a number? How do you quantify that?
It's a good question, and it's one aspect that I actually was not involved at all, and I was very happy not to, because anything like value is a very vague concept, and we basically let the curators choose. So if you're a curator, again, it's a little bit of going back to the choosing your favorite children. If I have this set of collections of materials and know that this ship is sinking, which ones would I save first? That's generally what I would tell people. But it's a struggle, and curators don't like to do that at all. When you tell them, you know, it could be that some of these collections may be gone in 20 years. They don't like going through that process, like just like every parent wouldn't like to choose his favorite children. It was a struggle to get them to do it. But I tend to think of more in comparative terms than in absolute terms. That's the ship sinking analogy.
We're trying to create a structured process to rank research value. We had that with that Cultures in Conflict digital archive that I showed you about. But that's just one little project And we're now faced with having to do a little more general ranking of research value and are starting to come up to come up with some structured way to do that. In other words, when I say a structured way, assigning points for certain criteria in a way that's defined and that's spelled out so that there's some consistency there and hopefully some integrity to the process.
But there are,
it's a difficult thing to do.
Yeah, because imagine your collection got acquired by a different university who was not focused on traditional music. You know,
right.
If their main concern was spoken word, well, maybe then it's very difficult to set an absolute value.
And it may not scale from institution to institution. It may really only be consistent to rank research value within one institution.
Yeah, I'm curious as to whether any of your programs offer a user the opportunity to either add fields or add options within a field. I'm thinking, for instance, that within the archives of within a radio archive, there's a phenomenon of zebra tape as a category, which is when multiple types of tape spliced, salvaged and spliced onto the same reel. And obviously that needs to be flagged, and that's an option that may not exist in an academic archive where people actually could afford to buy new tape all the time.
In FACET, the other factor section essentially allows you to add a field and to assign points for a condition like that. You can do that as many times as you want.
The way we deal with that too is, I think I mentioned that, is you can, for example, I would see some boxes where it literally would say, tape will not play back, but the tape looked fine. Well, I cannot give it a good rating, so I can go manually and give it my rating and then explain in the notes, this on the box says will not play back. So, and things, you can do anything like that. You can change all the ratings however you want.
Yeah, and also our ratings can be manually changed if you have a different opinion than it comes up with, or it's access database, so things can be added to it and changed.
That's the answer. Then.
Yeah, and also that we tried to build it because with the idea that different institutions will have different things. I mentioned about the PAL. We can't do anything with PAL, but maybe another institution can. So PAL would not be a bad rating for them. Like it would be for us. So that could be changed.
Mark?
I just wanted to kind of put in a plug for, really helpful to have visual, what does this condition look like? I'm working in a place now where we've got a lot of people with different backgrounds who are suddenly sort of being asked to assess, the condition of various types of sound recordings, and really helps. Like we actually grabbed, I think, a fascinating. We actually were using the visual images of what is this condition look like, and even some. If you're developing the manual part of this, it wouldn't be the rating part of it, but even maybe a little moving image. What happens if you clean this off a little bit? Are you looking at just gunk that can be cleaned off? Or are you looking at a real serious, inherent, problem that's developed over the years? Even a little bit of audio, what does severe tape spoken sound like? What are some of these conditions? What are we really concerned about? Or does this look worse than it sounds? Does it look awful, but actually?
Yeah, that's often the case.
So, just a request from the, and you might have the students or whoever is going to do this. The more guidance is the better.
Tape actually just put out a very good tutorial online for magnetic tape playback, which has little movies and whatnot. So, the European
project. It's a European project.
If you Google, I think ECAP. Tape? Is it ECAP?
Yeah, Dietrich Schuller's. Is involved.
Right. I can look it up later if you want.
It's
very
good. Training and.
Training on audiovisual preservation in Europe.
In Europe, right.
Training and audiovisual preservation in Europe.
John?
AKA Dietrich Schuller.
Because of each of you spoke of the potential for bias. Based on the knowledge. to see relatively how accurate they are, and are there any plan? I mean, I think assuming all of you have got grant hands in hand to do that, or is that something that's in the process of thought?
That's a very interesting idea. Yeah. I should mention that there's a fourth project based at the University of Illinois that's working on the same problem, and they're here as well, funded by IMLS. So.
Yeah, and if I could plug it just a little bit, based on what this lady was asking, we are intending to have it be pretty graphical and showing problems. And
that's great.
We're designing it for the non-expert, so maybe a little more entry level. So it's a lot of images and formats and problems and so forth.
I think the three of us are actually thinking of non-experts. So
yeah.
The four of us are thinking of non-experts.
We're on the same page then.
Yeah. The same printed with three.
Yeah, I was wondering, let's say I wanted to use Facet for, if I was writing up a planning grant for NEH and wanted to use Facet, has there been any feedback from them yet? I imagine it's too soon.
Well, Charlie Culp's been talking about it for a year in public, so I took that to mean that there was some pressure on me to actually produce this thing, which took way longer than I had hoped. My advice these days is if you have a certain time frame for doing something like this, just triple it and you'll be fine. It just came out, so I have no official feedback from Charlie except a thanks, we're really happy to see it, email. But I suspect that NEH would like to see folks using this Facet or a system like Facet to bring some structure to the process of selection so that you have some kind of a structured process that is reasonable and has some weight behind it.
And I would add to that, of course, the three of us have talked often, and I've often asked Mike for advice and suggestions. So there should be, the way I feel it would work if we did the test that you were talking about, is that the ones and the fives would be the same in both, in all of our surveys. It's the twos and threes and two and a halfs that may be a little different. But if you have something moldy, well, it's going to get a pretty bad rating in all of our surveys.
Yes.
And if you have something that looks pristine, it's polyester and it's perfectly wound, they're probably going to get a good rating in all of us. It's the shape, the gray areas that may not be as consistent, but in a way they're not that important.
I want to make an announcement before we quit. Okay. All right, we have time. Let's just take one last question. I believe this gentleman we talked about that, and Facet advisors unanimously thought that that was not a very good strategy to pursue because you end up mitigating the risk for stuff that is really in bad shape because its score is brought up by the stuff that's in good shape. So we really, really felt it was a much more valid strategy to divide into parts, rank separately, and then give all that information to your curatorial staff who can then say, all right, I see that this is in good shape, but it belongs with this, and I think I can justify transferring it together with that as part of the same collection. But we felt that was a curatorial level decision, and that's the way we approached that.
Well, I know Mike has an announcement he'd like to make, but before that, I just want to thank you all for all your questions. I'm really sorry we weren't able to answer all of them, but I encourage you to come and talk to these folks. Hopefully they'll be around for more of the conference.
If you have more questions about selection or anything else of a technical nature, this evening we have the Ask the Technical Committee session, which is in the Stratton Room back at the hotel, starting at 7:30. The Technical Committee will be there. We're open to any questions from the floor, and we'll have a discussion. So it should be a good chance to pursue some of these issues.
Okay. So again, a hand for our presenters, and thank you.